Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a podcast about all things digital assets, the global communities they are creating, the generations that are using and investing in them, and the challenges faced by the nations that are seeking to regulate them. The content of this program is not to be taken as investment advice. The opinions expressed in the program by the host and the guests are their personal opinions only. Remember, feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. My name is Derek Graham. I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management, and my co-host is Nitin Gower, Managing Director of State Street Digital Assets. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond Bitcoin. My name is Derek Graham. I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management. And of course, along with me today is my friend and colleague, Nitin Gower. Hey, Nitin, morning to you.
Hey, Derek, good morning. And we happen to be in the same time zone. I'm not very far away from you. I'm still in India. So good morning. And we said no more. You know, we are being too good, you know, DGens here. So good morning to you, Derek.
Absolutely. It's always morning time in the DGen space. I love that term. So that's why we're good morninging from now on. Wherever you are in the world, it's morning time. So look, always a lot happening. And we've had the wonderful indulgence for the last few weeks to talk about great projects, great tech, great movements of the marketplace. But we can't do this in absentia. And that is, we know Gary Gensler is raising his, raising his ugly head, and he's raising his ugly head and arguing the proposition that there needs to be more oversight and control by the SEC. Let's talk about that soon. And also we're seeing some of the, you know, we're seeing the by example, the BlackRock ETF for getting discussed, and BlackRock saying there's actually not as much appetite as they thought they would be for it. That'll be interesting. I'm not quite sure whether that is correct. Maybe it's not as much appetite as BTC's appetite. And at the same time, of course, we're seeing these giants, these large institutional giants, tokenizing real world assets, which on the surface of it is exciting, but as you and I have discussed, sometimes irrelevant. Why tokenize certain assets and certainly tokenize others? So we've got a basket to talk about today. So over to you, Nitin. Where would you like to start?
Derek, which is interesting. I took 2 days to go to some of the really ancient temples in India as a part of this holy week that we're in. And when I came back, and I went for a run this morning, I looked into a lot of interesting things that have transpired last week. Not only the Bitcoin ETF saga, a lot of outflows, and there are good reasons for the outflows, largely around GBTC, the tax implications, and Genesis bankruptcy court has probably approved them to liquidate some of the asset, which essentially implies the outflows, which had a price impact on Bitcoin itself. But what's interesting, which is what I was heads down for almost 2 years of my career at State Street, Derek, was tokenization of funds, tokenization of real estate assets. And I had a poignant perspective on when you tokenize a fund and put them onto a public blockchain, you're dealing with not only velocity mismatch, but the token fidelity mismatch. In the sense, the way tokens are created, the funds are managed in traditional finance, they have a certain structure to it. And that structure implies a lot of coordination with the various market participants in the existing market infrastructure. So you have a transfer agency, and you have a fund administration, you have a investment manager, and you have LPs and GPs. There's a whole slew of things that have to come together for a fund to take life and a fund to be able to be ready in transactional state. So when BlackRock and Uncle Larry, so this week is all about Uncle Larry and Uncle Gary, which to me, I'm always amazed at how much of crypto has been institutionalized, which was never the intention of where things are. But two notable things that happened. One is, of course, BlackRock is called its fund as BlackRock USD Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund, or BIDL. As you know, BIDL is the degen vernacular because somebody misspelled HODL for hold Bitcoin. You have all a specific vernacular in the degen world, and BIDL is the term for build, exactly what they have done with juxtaposing the letters. So they have named their fund as BIDL, which is to me is super interesting and very anecdotal in terms of what they want to achieve with this fund. But they took this traditional tokenized fund and put it on blockchain, on public blockchain. And my biggest challenge for 2 years, and I was working on the apparatus at State Street, is how do you prevent yourself from the nefarious activities or the inability to control which is not the case in traditional finance, of all the infrastructure and assets coming in, because now you have a wallet and you have an address and you have a smart contract. These are the lingua franca of the Bitcoin world. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. That the moment, you know, minutes, you know, it only took minutes after the crypto Twitter named the Ethereum address tied to the fund. And within a few seconds, you found the wallet was drowned with low quality meme coins and NFTs. Many of them were racist in their names, the talk coins. It was a mess. And I don't know what BlackRock is going to do with it. And that actually happens with everyone. That actually happened with you know, Brian Armstrong and with Vitalik and how they all got this meme coins and coins of no value. But now they had to deal with cleansing it because it's a financial institution. They have to account for things. And I'm really curious as to how they're going to do it. But I'm even more surprised that they never thought about this. Maybe they did and they were prepared for it, because I spend lion's share of my time at State Street, which is one of the largest financial institutions, yes, in figuring this out. Like, how do we prevent this from happening? And that is one of the biggest impediments. Not to mention, Derek, that January 3rd of 2023, which is last year, the JSOC, the Joint Financial sort of Stability Committee, which is a combination of three different government agencies, or FSOC, a Financial Stability Oversight Committee, they basically suggested that anything on public blockchain is not in line with safe banking practices. So this, and this is more of a recommendation than anything else, but BlackRock doing this is super bold. But I find it super interesting that what they're doing with this is paying the token holders daily yield, which is not the case with traditional finance. So that to me is a positive sign of this whole thing. But I always questioned the value of tokenizing a money market fund, because money market essentially is a combination, sort of a US Treasury bills, cash and repo or repurchase agreements. And the players here are BNY Mellon, USDC and BlackRock. It goes back to what USDC has done with keeping all their money with BlackRock as a fund and creating repo facilities and so on and so forth. So that relationship is coming after almost a year, coming to fruition of launch of this particular fund. So I think it's interesting. It's a progress in the right direction, though I have spent a lot of time in opining on this, where there is a velocity mismatch, there is a directional mismatch, there is a processing mismatch, which even though things are meant to be instant and liquidity generating, it's still a quite challenging task to issue a traditional finance on a public blockchain, because now but it's great for Ethereum because now it increases Ethereum utility. I'll say one more thing, Derek, and get your opinion. Is interestingly enough, they did not go with Polygon or Optimism as a layer two, which is lower fees. They went straight on Ethereum, which we know has had its challenges with processing costs and gas fees for processing transactions. And that to me is a testament of institutional great players relying upon the maturity of the platform and saying we'll pay a higher gas fee, but we want the surety and assurance of what Ethereum has to offer, which I think bodes great about Ethereum network. So I'll pause here, Derek, to see if that made sense.
Yeah. So what I would say is that it's interesting that we are having to, and I think we'll continue to, discuss what's happening with the large institutions and their impact into this realm of what used to be previously controlled by the degens in the space that wanted to really create an alternative financial future. And what we see in this is Uncle Larry at BlackRock saying, we want a piece of that financial future. And we want a piece of this, and we're going to start tokenizing things that we understand. And we're going to do it in a manner that is the most effective manner of this time in history. So they're looking at tokenizing bonds and putting them onto the Ethereum network. I think it's fair to say that between you and I, we would agree that's not the most adventurous tokenization process. And in some cases, you'd ask, why would you bother? They're already liquid. They're already highly tradable. Why are you bothering to put it onto a blockchain at all? So that is an interesting thing. From a macro point of view, we're going to be looking at this and going, this kind of realm at the moment is maybe the realm of blockchain 2.5, you know, not 2.0 or 3.0, like Web 2.0 or 3.0, Blockchain 2.5, because you're seeing you're seeing the institutions come and take the pieces that they see. I don't necessarily think we've seen a lot of creativity in the institutions at the moment. The tokenization of real world assets is going to be an inevitable outcome, which is going to be fantastic for digital assets, by the way. You decide to tokenize, if there's tokenization of commercial real estate, tokenization of you know, these other financial instruments, very, very large amounts of assets we put on to the realms of the various blockchain communities. And that will mean that those large assets will start looking towards things such as decentralized finance to leverage them, finance them, etc., which is another way of taking the asset away from the existing banking communities by just chance of where it's getting digitized and putting it into a digitized world where the owners of those assets would naturally go, well, I've got the globe now to look for funding to fund my building or my assets. So I think in due course, we're going to see extraordinary growth in the decentralized finance section because tokenization of real-world assets is going to occur, of which these bonds and treasuries, as you're saying, are part of that process. So interesting observation, Nitin, and fascinating to think that you have been sitting and watching for 2 years the exact problem that BlackRock has just encountered, which is everybody taking the mickey out of them by bolting on meme tokens to their chain. It's interesting. So, Nitin, what about what Gary Gensler's doing at the moment? It's not sudden.
Yeah,
he's
so
been actively doing
Larry
this for a while.
Uncle Gary.
Uncle Gary.
Okay. So, yeah. So let's move from Uncle Larry to Uncle Gary. And I think what's interesting, Derek, is while it may be insignificant today, still sticking on to the BlackRock Biddle, which is the institutional digital liquidity fund, which is a money market fund. If you recall, there were some projects that I was opining on again on Twitter to say there were some Ethereum project that I was looking into having degens trading on the yield. So which means you keep your core asset and you simply trade the yield of an asset. And I think this is a first step in creating that converged future where if I'm tokenizing my real assets and real world assets and real world instruments with crypto, they have to be in the same form factor. So tokenizing these assets, give them the same form factor, which I'm assuming that in 5 or 10 years, which is the vision that I had when I moved on to State Street, is the ability for them to be able to trade these sort of assets together. But moving on to Uncle Gary, what's interesting was that they were, and it's interesting, we should, towards the end of this podcast today, opine for our listeners and investors, how did they make sense of these things? That there was some inquiry, for example, there were some areas where, you know, the SEC is likely looking into reclassifying Ethereum as native token as security. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it has all kinds of challenges. And the way we learned about this is that Ethereum Foundation's Canary, which is again a reference to the Canary in coal mine, which indicates whether a government has probed the website and has come down eventually. And some of the citing of that was listed in the GitHub, which is a code repository of Ethereum Foundation. And what's interesting was that they didn't mention SEC. They did mention a state agency or state body, which the assumption it's going to be SEC, and everybody's mind went towards the SEC because there have been a lot of long-standing issue with Ethereum. But what's challenging about this is that there are statute of in this legal framework that you can go after. It's been 10 years since Ethereum was launched, a little over 10 years. So you've passed the 7-year, 8-year mark where you can really go after something. Second thing is that we don't know if the investigation pertains to the initial coin offering because Ethereum did have an ICO back in the day, which raised the initial fund. So there were a bunch of investors in solicitation of funds. So I do agree with SEC on that front. But again, the time has passed. It has, you know, this is again going back to Hester Peirce's sort of model of having a safe harbor to give projects 2 years to evolve and not throw books at them so that they can flourish. Second thing is that how does a U.S. security regulator has a jurisdiction over an agency that's based in Zug? Because Ethereum Foundation is based in Zug. It's not a U.S.-based entity. The second thing is that back in the day, the CFTC, the Commodities Future Trading Commission, which oversees the Bitcoin ETH futures market, you've had this futures trading for, gosh, over 7+ years now. and that market has gone. So what happens to those assets and those markets and those market makers and all the transactions that have transpired? And what about the other projects that like things like Ethereum Classic, Ethereum POW, which is the pre-merge preservation of the original Ethereum network after the merge it went to proof of stake? So you have all these questions, which I don't think SEC neither has the acumen nor the jurisdiction rule after. And second thing is that if SEC has already implicitly said ETH is a commodity after it allowed the launch of ETH Future, because ETH Future is a security and it's governed by, you know, by the, you know, the ETFs that are securities, it's governed by SEC. So they've already allowed them to trade with SEC's blessing, which implies that they have accepted the CFTC's assertion that ETH is a commodity. So these are like all real open questions. And I think the industry in general, which many of us, many of the pundits, many of them who are pro crypto, like all of us, we are looking into saying that this is probably Gary Gensler's or SEC's last hurrah before they exit to say, hey, we're going to put this in legal quagmire and have enough legal challenges that will take some time, which will put the industry at halt in many of exactly what they had done with XRP. If you remember XRP era, when they designated security, XRP stopped trading, liquidity was scarce. They had all kinds of challenges with XRP. I think the challenge is let them do this for a few years and let the legal battles ensue while they exit, or when, you know, when the next administration or the, you know, or the next chair takes over. So to me, these are some of the assertions. I don't think there's a lot of clarity, but I think this is just misplaced and it's going to create a lot of havoc, because unlike Bitcoin ETF, which was a single asset class for a single sort of token, Ethereum is, the implication around something like this for Ethereum is, has graver sort of challenges, I think, Derek, because you have a very rich and very massive ecosystem, which is in multiples of billions of dollars now flourishing on Ethereum ecosystem, and that all of them eventually are impacted if Ethereum is classified as security. So we'll see where this goes, but I think there'll be a lot of, it'll be a much, much more bigger focus area than what we have seen in the past with XRP lawsuit.
And of course, you've got to always bring US politics into this, because we're heading towards an election, and there is a crypto lobby group that has stated they have at their disposal $80 million to lobby and put their view forward. They have asked each one of the candidates throughout America to provide an advisory note to them on what their stance is on crypto. And that's interesting. It's putting them on notice, saying that we need to know where you stand on crypto. Now, they need to be answering that with the view that if they stand against crypto, there's $80 million worth of money that will go to lobby potentially against them. So, you know, you are seeing quite a whirlpool of various parties that are actively involved with this. What does this mean to us, and what does it mean to investors? You know, the area of instability is never a great thing for an investment class. So watching it is an important thing in our role as investment managers. Our view continues to be, and I've used this analogy before, that this crypto industry is an enormous river full of eddies. But we can't tell when one eddy is going to open and close, but we do know this enormous river is heading to the ocean. It's as simple as that. And so we think there's no question about its future, but the journey there is going to have this impact of various legal actions, lobby groups, politics, etc., on the way through. And this is no different. Gary Gensler has, you know, I think it's fair to say, been acting disingenuously right through his view on this, and he's been caught out by the courts doing exactly that, and them citing him as, you know, really being somewhat malicious in how he's attacked these various companies. So you have to ask yourself, then, what's behind Gary Gensler being so malicious? Is this a good career move for him? I don't know whether it is a good career move for him, Nitin, but nonetheless, he appears to be doing it. So as we move forward, we're seeing the giant institutions moving forward, full stop. Yep. And then you're seeing Then you're seeing Gary Gensler in the SEC saying, oh, hang on a sec. How are we going to regulate this? How are we going to control this? This is out of our purview. It doesn't seem to be working with the laws. And wait a sec, these are global and international companies, structures, or they have no company and structure. How do we regulate that? It really is somewhat difficult for them to do it. So my guess is the way Gary Gensler is going to approach this is he's going to muddy the waters and act more like a gangster. I know I'm being very harsh against him, but act more like a gangster than he is going to act like a lawmaker, and that is provide threats and muddy waters. And so we as investors simply need to keep our eye on this and realize it's an additional aspect to this asset class, which will, which will impact its volatility.
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to add as we wrap, Derek, absolutely. I think, and that's our job to educate investors as we see the industry and have informed and empirical opinions, which means that we are looking at data, we're looking at subjective and quantitative information to process and say, what's the risk here? And we have, as you know, a very robust risk model framework to address those challenges. What's interesting, Derek, which we haven't really talked about is stablecoins. In amidst all this stuff, and that's beyond SEC's jurisdiction in general, stablecoin represents, again, settlement instrument. Settlement in the US is a jurisdiction between multiple agencies, Federal Reserve, which is a central bank, but also FinCEN, which is the agency that looks into financial crimes enforcement network, are some of the agents that govern the movement of money in general. And if you look at the sum total of all the stable coins that have emerged, in fact, if you look at the BlackRock's BIDL, which is the Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund, it is entrenched into USDC. So USDC, as you know, is a stable coin entity. They have a relationship in creating a reverse repo facility with BlackRock as a fund. And that money is then kept safe as a custody with BNY Mellon. So there's like all these institutions coming together from this perspective. But stablecoins, if stablecoins were to be a country, it would be the sixth largest holder of US Treasury around the world. Yeah. So it's believe it or not, it's not just institutionalization of crypto. The crypto itself is ingrained so deeply into the economic system that it's just a matter of a few years, exactly as we expect in 2024, the stablecoin-based transaction to surpass Visa and MasterCard, which is $7 trillion worth of transactional volume. We expect stablecoins volume to grow only because that becomes a transactional currency for not just tokenized funds, but also as a medium of exchange for the exchanges and the other crypto assets, which I think is something which may change the perspective and force the hand of Congress to think about this, because now it's suddenly just like China and India and many other countries are biggest holder of US debt, in many cases, stablecoin becomes that entity from that perspective. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Derek, if I can venture into making some predictions, that it'll be the stablecoin that will force the hand of the regulatory apparatus to start thinking about having a sensible regulation. Because now, you know, as the holder of US Treasury, they have a say in terms of where things are heading, and they become a de facto vehicle as a transfer mechanism in large volumes and value across the various ecosystems around the world, which I think is very, very sizable for us to not to ignore, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense. And what sort of does surprise me is that the US government hasn't embraced stable coins, because the vast majority of them are US dollar stable coins. They don't have to be, but they are mostly dominated by US dollar stable coins. The other thing that I'm always amazingly surprised with is that what an awesome business model stable coins are currently. I mean, it's like it's just the greatest. At any rate, so you buy a stable coin, which means that someone, the owner of the stable coin group, has your money, and they have that money then placed in US dollar treasury. So they're getting their 3%, 4%, 5%, depending on what the period of time of the interest rate is, for nothing. You're not getting the interest, they are. And a lot of the reason this still exists is because to provide a stable coin with interest then hits the definition of a security token. And so a lot of people haven't done it. There are big institutions, I know for a fact, that are looking at designing a stablecoin with interest to be used outside the USA. And I would imagine they're going to become very popular for those that are reversing in and out of stablecoins. They prefer to be able to receive interest on the way through. So yeah, so this journey around stablecoins is an interesting journey because it is that hybrid of fiat currencies and the ability to transact in digital format on a blockchain. The other aspect of it is that you talk about just the enormity of volume turnover with fiat stablecoins, and you kind of think, well, wait, maybe that's because they're a better method of transacting. They are the sort of go-to reversed method for taking money in and out of the market. So if you think of transactions, people are investing normally from a stablecoin into let's say a Bitcoin, then they're exiting the Bitcoin into a stablecoin, and then they're exiting a stablecoin into another token. Of course, you should be doing that on a DEX, but this is the reason why you're seeing such an enormous turnover of stablecoins. Not because they're superior, because this is the current culture of how we're doing business in this space. Yeah. Where are we heading, Nitin?
No, I agree. No, I think so too. Again, to wrap things up, I think pragmatic elements. I think any new industry has to go through a lot of chaotic moments. I think crypto is no different from what internet used to be, except that because it's transferring a lot of value, it has a little bit more maturity curve and adoption rate than the 10-year journey that internet had. But we are there. I think that I somehow have this feeling that all these chaotic regulatory responses from around the world, that includes Europe and US, and then you have institutions pushing this in terms of embracing the asset class, and then you have the Turkeys of the world and the Argentinians of the world who are embracing Bitcoin as a store of value, is having true faith. Retails coming through in the US and abroad, not just through ETF vehicles, but also. So to me, these are movements not happening in fragments, but there is a method to this madness, which I think eventually at some point the regulatory apparatus would have to come to its knees and take a pragmatic perspective, because regulation is not necessarily bad because it protects the investors and consumers, but they have to embrace it to say, we need to think about this differently. So when every time a regulator tells us that, hey, we've had regulation for 100 years in the books, not understanding the technical sort of innovations and ramifications of the changes that needs to be done, I feel that that needs to happen. So to me, it's we're in the last stage of acceptance. And that's usually what happens. And if you look at any of the revolution, and me being from India, there was a whole thing that, the Brits fought with the freedom fighters. And eventually, India prevailed, for example, in its freedom. I would imagine that at some point, the regulators are fighting that whole point, and eventually the crypto industry will prevail. But I think that at some point, self-governance is paramount. The industry should say that, we're doing all the right things. And to me, my only concern is meme coins. But again, not a concern anymore because it's a cultural shift that happens in every market. There's baseball cards. There are all kinds of things that are collectibles, and I only view them as collectibles, not be confused with real things of value in our economic system.
Mm, agreed. So we as a fund have a view. This is not investment advice, but we as a fund have a view that the regulation overview of the SEC is going to cause ongoing volatility, but ultimately they are going to have to adjust to this new global economy. And the reason why is because there are so many countries that will benefit from this, such as Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, India, etc. And they will just move forward at pace and develop faster and faster and better ways to manage their money, borrow money, transact, buy, tokenize. And the US will be sitting there going, they are leaving us behind. And so my view is that they will impact volatility, but they will ultimately acquiesce to the market to a degree, and that they'll start updating their regulations so that they're relevant to this totally new asset class. Maybe I'm being utopian, but that's the way we see the path forward.
I do agree with you. And again, at Portal, I think we are spending enormous amount of energy lately, especially to dissect these things as our teams grow, as our research efforts grow, Derek. And again, good leadership there from you and Mark, and looking forward to, again, you know, continue chipping away at this industry, as we say.
Terrific. That's great, Nitin. Hey, next week, let's get back into some technologies and see some of the great moving tokens. We might even dissect, like we did before when we looked at Injective, some of the tokens that we have, that we've delved into, invested into, deployed to, et cetera. Maybe share our rationale of why. And so in the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Please share with other like-minded friends by all means, and always reach out to us anytime you want to discuss topics. Sure. Have a great week in India, Nitin, and I'll see you in a week's time. Bye for now.
Sounds good. Take care, Derek. Ciao. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed our weekly conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or suggested topics, please contact Nitin Gaur or myself on the emails displayed here or via our LinkedIn profiles. Feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. Stay well, inquisitive, and engaged. See you next week.